All right, now let me see how we're doing here.
Okay.
Looks like it's all right. Okay.
Well, refresh my memory where we were.
You had just had an offer.
Oh, that's
you decided
right.
not to take it.
That's right, yes. Yeah, I went through kind of a low spot and so on, and I seriously thought about selling the library. And I thought Harry would be buying this thing for, say, $19,000 or $20,000. And being a Beverly Hills dealer, loads of money down there, I thought, well, he'll easily double it. And I thought, I'm just not quite ready to sell. I'm just not quite ready. I was on the brink, but I didn't want to, you know, take that next step. Fortunately for CHF, yes. So anyway, I did send out these lists, and I got, it was obvious that my prices were very fair. I accurately described these items. And I sold most of them. Unfortunately, I sold two or three which I've never been able to replace, and minor 18th century work, but they're very rare. No great loss there on spell orders and things like that, but anyway, it doesn't matter. They're gone.
But these were to university libraries.
Yes, to university libraries. I went to one, I know, went to Harvard, and I was surprised they would even not have anything that I would have. So. And they went to the Houghton Library there in Harvard, and then there was another one that went to Urbana, University of Illinois, Urbana,
mm-hmm.
and several other places. One went to Utah, and one went to a position in New Jersey. Oh, yes, that's another thing. I found another copy of Boyle's Skeptical Chemist, and I believe it was my second copy. No, it was my third copy. My second one I still have. The third copy, I wish it was bound in Dutch vellum, so it must have gone from England to Holland, bound over in Holland. But I believe I paid something like $1,000 for it at the time. This is way back in the early 70s. And this man in New Jersey, I charged him, I think, $2,000. And he had a copy of Tyson's Orangutan, or the, I've forgotten the date, somewhere in the 1680s, the comparison between man's structure and the structure of a gorilla. And I didn't particularly want it, but I thought, well, maybe I can take it and sell it myself somewhere else for a bit of money. So I think I charged him $2,000. For my $1,000 book, double my money, just a la rare book dealers, plus his copy of the orangutan. Or, what was it? Orangutan, see they, what's it called now? Homo sylvestris, I think, or the man in the woods. I completely forgot the date, and it's not like me to forget dates, but I'm not infallible, so. It's somewhere in the 1680-1690 period. Nice fellow, but had nothing whatsoever to do with chemistry. And so anyway, I finally traded that in on some chemistry books to somebody else. But as I say, it went on, and the book prices were going up and up and up. And then I think it was around about 1975, I believe. I'm not absolutely certain of that date. But the books took a quantum leap. They just about tripled in a year or two, Dawson's a pound now. And instead of being £25, Boyle suddenly became £75, £100, and way, and they're just going skyward.
Was there any reason for that?
Well, it was just Dawson. They just bought out another company, and they decided to, a bunch of sort of cowboys went in there, and they were out for blood. So, of course, all the other dealers thought, well, if they can get that kind of money, we're going to get that kind of money. So then I went into high gear, and I was literally putting out every penny I could, or every dollar I could, buying these early chemistry books. I thought, well, maybe what they can do, I can do. In the meantime, I met a dear old gentleman called Emil Offenbacher. Do you know that name at all?
No, I don't.
Well, he was kind of like the doyen of early chemistry booksellers in New York. And he and I became close friends, and he would offer me pre-catalog offers. They were never cheap, but they were fair. And they were almost always excellent copies. And so between Heller and Offenbach and Lathrop Harper in New York, all these people are long dead, long out of business. And me, there was another one called Technical Library Services. It was in downtown Manhattan. I remember when I was in New York at an ACS meeting, I took the subway down there and got off there and found them. And I bought a copy of Athanasius Kircher's Mundus Subterraneus, one of the rare first issues of the first edition, with the first title page 1664, the second title page 1665. And so I bought that book from them. A huge volume, absolute classic on the subterranean world. Lots of chemistry, lots of everything. About subterranean fires, and beautifully illustrated, full of engravings and so on. I ended up, I believe, with a 4 or 5 Athanasius Kircher's finding, which are all now at CHF. Let's see, where are we now? Well, anyway, getting back to Sondheimer and the sale of his library, I just literally, by then, I was consulting and so on, so I was making some real money then. I think between us, Gene and I were making about $200,000 a year. And I was paying myself, I think I was making roughly somewhere between, depending on which year we're talking about, somewhere between $120,000 and $140,000 a year. And since I was self-employed, I set up my defined benefit pension plan, and I defined the benefit that I wanted at age 65, or whenever I retired, and paid myself accordingly. And one of the reasons I get a very low Social Security now is I think my top salary is a PhD of working for myself. I sunk just about all the money into my pension plan, and I started out $13,000 a year for a PhD, and I went up as high as $18,000 a year, because my taxman said, you know, you're not paying yourself enough, so you know, that's going to raise the red lights at the IRS. So I ended up paying myself. So now I don't get very much Social Security, you know, less than $900 a month, even now. But that's all right. I've still got the other money, and it's grown. So I guess I was playing it smart anyway. But I was sucking away every buck I could into rare books. And I expanded that into not only just plain chemistry, but mining, metallurgy, and general properties of matter, which of course includes some physics books. And I decided, my goodness, I better come along and try to get some Newtons and so on. I already had Newton's optics. I bought a beautiful copy of the first edition from Blackwell's in Oxford. And I bought an even more beautiful copy from another man, George Walford in London. And now we were getting up there in price. We're talking about $4,000 or $5,000. Of course, it seems ridiculous now, in today's prices, but optics cost around $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, depending on the copy, if you can find a copy. But in those days, that was a huge amount of money. We're talking 30-odd years ago. And finally, I ended up with 2 copies of Newton's optics. And it had some chemistry, sort of peripheral chemistry in it, discussing colors and indicators and, you know, little things that are peripheral. I suppose you could call it physical chemistry or chemical physics, whatever. And I was very, very pleased. So I finally traded in one of the copies, my lesser copy, although beautiful, of the optics, back to McDowell and Stern. It actually appeared on their front cover. The title page right on the front cover of their catalog. And for that, I took in a copy of Young's works, Thomas Young, you know, 1806, a beautiful copy of that, and I think about 10 other books. So it was basically a trade. And one of those was the extremely rare 1615 edition of the works of Alexis of Piedmont. And that particular copy, I don't think they realized, was an exception in that usually it has, I believe, four so-called books in it, four sections of books. They call them books, you know, not chapters. And this one had a fifth, which is unknown in most copies. And it was original binding. It's obviously been in the same old library for centuries, so I was very, very pleased with that. And that was pretty much just a trade for only one copy of Newton's Objects. So anyway, let's get back to Sondheimer. All I can say is from the 50s through to about the 80s, I was either working for somebody else or setting up my own company and so on. And just basically our savings account was books. And we had some money in account, but I mean nothing about what we had in the value of the books. That was our chief holding. And we were still buying these houses and so on to get some equity. So along comes 1980, I think it was, and Sondheimer's books go on the market. I just swooped in after the dealers, and I bought probably about $35,000 to $40,000 worth of Sondheimer's books, which you can plainly see because he had his little book plate on an 8-membered ring in there. And and then he told me by letter that he was going to come over to Stanford on a sabbatical. Now, I didn't realize Sondheimer was a terribly sick man, mentally sick. I don't know whether you know that or not, but he was on lithium, on drugs, and he was a sick boy. A very, very nice fellow, but he seemed to me like an extremely good chemist who'd never quite grown up. Wasn't quite of this world, you know. And then what happened? He came to my library and said, oh, he phoned me up and said, I'm here now. He said, I would very much like to spend an hour or so with your library, meet you personally. And anyway, so I said, all right, well, how about Saturday? And so we agreed. And he drove over in this little car that belonged to Carl Durasi. And it was called... Smith 1. That was a license plate. Smith 1. Mm-hmm. I said, that's a weird license plate. It stands for, it's an acronym for Syntex Made It Possible. Syntex Made It Possible. So anyway, Jurassic had lent him this little car. And he showed up in this car, and he was a man at that time, I think about, 53. Just about ready to turn 54. Very professorial type, you know, glasses, and came in and I showed him my library, which then filled, well, pretty much the whole of the basement, but not the two rooms in my regular city house. Now, at that time, I'd learned from the dealers, various dealers who'd seen that his library was about 1,500 books plus whatever he had in Boyle. He had about 1,650 total. And he thought he had the biggest collection in private hands in the world. He walked into our library, which was about 33 feet long by about 20 feet wide, floor-to-ceiling books on chemistry and mining metallurgy, anything like that, and his jaw just fell open. He went into deep shock. He just couldn't believe it. And so, not that I was trying to brag about it, I didn't know how big his life. I mean, I knew it was smaller than mine, but I didn't know. And he had some gorgeous stuff, which I had bought or was in the process of buying later. Anyway, we went through the 16th century, we went through the 15th century books I had at the time, and the 16th century books, and some of the 17th century books. And, oh, by the way, I should also add that I found out that Wing's short title catalogue of books printed in England and the English colonies abroad was coming out in the second edition. Well, I missed the first volume of that. So I wrote to the editor, whose name completely escaped me, unfortunately, and said that I happen to have a lot of Wing books. Would you be interested in knowing which books I have in the Wing period? I have lots of, I've got about over 1,000 of books. Not all of the Wing that would be listed in Wing, but A lot of them, which are either listing one or two copies in Wayne, or very, very few copies anyway. So I put together this great big long list of things which would obviously be of interest to Wayne, Carol. And so I, in volume two, I enlisted as the symbol CRN, which stands for California Roy Neville. Now, in volume three, which came out, which is the last volume that came out in that series, which was the, I think, Peter Z or something like that, the letter Peter Z, I looked up my library, my symbols, and I wasn't there. I thought, well, what's going on? So then they changed the symbolism, so the private libraries now appear as XRN, see, I'm XRN. And it turned out that my library, now at CHF, was the only science library at all in Wayne. The only one. I was rather proud of that. A little bit of bragging rights here, but not that type of guy, but you know, it turned out that way. So getting back to Sondheimer, I remember he came over again about a month later, and during the course of that month, apparently he had had, while he was in England, he had a fellowship from the Royal Society of London. Well, due to budgetary restraints, they had decided, since he wasn't going to be there, they would terminate his fellowship. And he had some sort of salary from the University of London, and he was in the next office of Bill Smeaton, you know, W.A. Smeaton? Who was a personal friend of mine, too. I wrote an article on McCurr's Dixon editor to me, which, by the way, to me that was one of the most unappreciated books of the 18th century, because it was the first encyclopedia of chemistry. He called it a dictionary, it was an encyclopedia of chemistry. It brought together all the pre-Lavoisier period, all into one place, so to speak. And it was an excellent little thing. It came out in three editions of 1766, all of which I had. And I had written an article on McKernan's Dictionaries for me, or I think JKMA. Anyway, Smeaton came over and saw this, and he was interested in that. And I said, why don't we jointly write an article? So he and I wrote this nice article. It was, I'd say, about two-thirds his work and one-third mine. And Bill called another, William A. Cole, who was I met down in Pacific Palisades when I was in Southern California, sort of joined in to sort of add his two cents worth, so to speak. Anyway, out came this nice, definitive article on McKernan's dictionary, all the way from 1766 right up to, I believe, about 1803, when it was ceased to be called McKernan. It was two other fellows whose, frankly, my name, my terrible name escapes me right now, but if you go to the article, you find out. I think it was Cadet de Gassicourt and somebody else. Anyway, I got all kinds of requests for reprints for that, because it really is kind of like the definitive account of McKernan's dictionary and all the background. And of course, McKernan died in 1784, but it was continued on. And I believe I had about 20 or 22 different editions in all different languages and issues and states, which all of which are now over at CHF. And I was always interested in dear old McCurr. He was kind of a nice guy. He did work for a while with Lavoisier in a circle. Anyway, getting back to Sondheimer, Sondheimer came a second time, and the first time, I should say. He said, I can only spend about an hour. Well, he came around 2 o'clock, and by about 7 o'clock at night, I was getting pretty hoarse. We hadn't had anything, we had a cup of tea and a cup of cookies. And so I said to Gene, why don't we take him out to dinner? So we broke off at about 8:30 and drove down to the Velvet Turtle, met his wife and so on, and had a nice dinner. So about a month later, he came over again. By the way, the first time, we'd only gotten up to about the mid-1650s and just barely touching Boyle. And he'd never seen all of those books that I had, and was extremely interested, you know, and he got all excited about it. And always got to try to get a copy of this and a copy of that and so on. A month later it came, and of course in the meantime, the Royal Society discontinued his part of his income. And so for some reason they went into a deep, deep depression. I didn't know it until later. He came there and we sort of polished off, using colloquialism, polished off some of the 17th century. And I said, well, he wanted to be called Franklin in France. So I said, well, Franklin, when you come again, we'll attack the 18th century. That's my colloquialism, we'll attack the 18th century. And he gave me a look as much to say, I'm not sure whether we will or not. There was a sort of a distance in his eyes. His eyes sort of glazed over somehow or other. And about 2 weeks after that, I was over there at this laboratory I was using down in River City, and I was talking to Art Burton, who was the head of the laboratory, and he said, oh, by the way, did you hear about your friend Sondheimer? He said, it was in the local paper. I said, no, what about him? He said, he's dead. I said, oh, no, what are you talking? It must be different. No, he said he committed suicide. Did you know about this?
I did a paper once on chemists who committed suicide.
So you knew about that?
But peripherally.
All right, so I went to shock. I thought, my God, I knew he had a very surprise reaction to see my library, and that combined with the Royal Society cancelling, just stopping his stipend, whatever you call it. And I called up Smeaton, and I'm going to quote Smeaton. He said, that damn fool. He said, the University of London would have picked up the difference anyway. And he said, no, he was a very sick man. And I learned through Smeaton, unfortunately, he's dead now too, that he was on lithium, and he'd married this woman who had a daughter who had died at 18, who Sondheimer loved his stepdaughter very much, had it affecting deeply. And his wife was a real, I hate to say nasty things about people, but she was a real virago or a vixen. She was not a particularly nice person. She was criticizing him and chewing on him all the time. And to me it was like a chalk and cheese situation. I mean, I couldn't see Sondheimer and this woman. It was oil and water, night and day. I couldn't see anything in common between those two, but who am I to say? So anyway,
Was this one of the first times you had shown your library to another chemist?
Oh, no.
Or you had been...
Oh, I've shown it to quite a few book dealers and so on.
But chemists, I mean, historians or chemists?
Now, Arnold, okay, of course, I've known Arnold from not only by name, but by correspondence and telephone calls, and then finally Arnold came back to the West Coast and I said, well, if you can, I know you're busy, but if you can sort of steal a few hours, you might be interested in this. So I believe it was in 1984 that he came out, and I think right around about 1980 at Christmas, Gina gave me a long book for my desk to record a few choice words in. And Sondheimer, and it's down in the garage, and I haven't unpacked a whole lot of book boxes, somewhere in the garage. And Sondheimer had written in that book, he said, I'll paraphrase because I don't remember the exact words, thank you so much for letting me see what is probably the best private library on chemistry in the world. Best wishes from Sondheimer, and the date. And then some other people came and so on, and I decided to start, recording all this. And then in 1984, I'm pretty sure it's 1984, Arnold came and he said some very complimentary things and so on. And of course the book dealers that came in, they were just, agape with what was going on. And, I was just shoveling these books in, realizing these things were getting away from me, so I better just grab hold of the real big stuff while it was still available and I could afford it. So I bought things which are not strictly chemical, like Gilbert's De Magneti of 1600, gorgeous copy, bound together with a book by, I think, Paduanius of, I think, 1600 or 1601. It's the first book on winds and wind currents, sort of a meteorological interest, but they're bound together. in an Italian binding. De Magnete is the second part of that volume. And anyway, I also bought all four editions of Agricola's De Re Metallica of 1556, 1561, what's the next one? I think 1633 and 1654. And then one day, Ed Glazer called me and said, Ed was a wonderful book for you. I bought many, many gorgeous books from him. He said, I've got a copy of De Re Metallica, Roy, of 1630. I said, what? You have? And that was the original De Re Metallica. It's just a little tiny duodecimo. It was Agricola's first true scientific book on mining metallurgy. It's usually known as the Bermanus. Incredible rare thing. And anyway, I think it was Marte and Land in New York. Well, they really wanted that particular copy. But Ed was so nice, he said, look, I'm going to offer it to Roy. So he offered it to me. So I said, can you send it over to me? So we negotiated, and I believe I paid something like $40,000 for it. Huge sum to me in those days. And anyway, I beat out my Martin Land. They were listed probably for $100,000 easily. It's one of these things you never occur. Now, just to show you how rare that thing is, you know Herbert Hoover's version of Damer, it translates to 1912. They never actually owned a copy of that. He collected for around 25 years, never found a copy. And of course, he was quite wealthy, being a mining engineer and so on, as well as a president. And he could never find a copy. It's that rare. Now at CHF. The little thing about, about 3/8 inch thick, itty bitty thing, nice early vellum binding. I'm not sure it's original, but it's certainly a very early one. And there it is. I was very, very pleased to add that. As well as many, many other, I'll talk in mining books, I could tell you about the history of three of them.
Excuse me.